Welcome to the Business Trendsetter Podcast, where we talk about trends and how to grow your business. My name is Manny Turan.
And I'm Adam Hartung.
We are Spark Partners. We help your business to grow by understanding your customers and, of course, understanding trends. And this is actually the subject of today's podcast, is a little bit about what trends are, how to identify them, and how to tell the difference between a trend and a fad. Now, Adam, I've been on a health kick the past about a year and a half, trying to get in shape, stay in shape. And I'm holding here some collagen that is kind of out there to be able to add protein to your diet, to be able to get the gains from working out, build muscle and so forth. And, you know, collagen is in this whole movement. Would you consider that a trend or a fad?
The supplements business is definitely on a trend. And that trend is the desire that people have to lead a healthier lifestyle. That trend has been in place for 20 years and shows no sign of change. Now, some people might think that sounds kind of odd, but if you go back in time, if you go back to, say, the turn of the century, from the 1800s to the 1900s, men that were in position of power, leaders of organizations, were expected to be corpulent. And that was because it was considered, you know, a good sign that you could, you know, you had a lot of money and you could eat very well and you had plenty of money to buy beef and, you know, and therefore they expected leaders to be corpulent. And so, and lifestyles back then were not particularly vigorous. And so, you know, the average person at that turn of the century, you know, lived to be about 55 to 58. That was about the lifestyle. When we say today we're talking about being healthy, we think, well, people have always tried to be healthy. And the reality is, no, that's not true. People didn't always try to eat healthy. They had different reasons that dominated their eating habits. So what we saw was that transition really started in sort of the 80s. We started to see more of a health kick where people started going to health clubs, getting more exercise. They start talking about regular exercise. They start saying you live longer if you exercise daily. They started discussing, you know, if you reduced fat in your diet, if you reduced carbohydrates in your diet. These things became more popular starting in the 80s and it moved along. And simultaneously, the product you have is the supplement. And the supplements business was, you know, sort of one-a-day vitamins and Geritol in 1965. It really wasn't much of a business. Now you can walk into a Whole Foods, about any pills part of a grocery store, and there's a lot of product there. There's a lot of pills that you can take. There are a lot of bars, as you show, that you can eat. There are, you know, things that you can pour into liquids and drink. Things to improve your vitamin B, things to improve your colon health. There's not a part of your body, joints to eyes to brain that, you know, to hearing, that doesn't have some kind of a supplement now that people could try to take to improve their lifestyle. And the benefit of that is that we do now live much longer. You know, I've mentioned before that when Franklin Roosevelt implemented Social Security, he set the retirement age at 65. That was because that was the average life expectancy in the 1940s was 65 years. And so the odds were that, you can retire because you're not going to live much longer. The average life expectancy now is well into the 80s. You know, I've forgotten the number now, but there's something like 30,000 people in the United States over 100 years old. And it wasn't that long ago, you know, 15 years ago, that you would watch Good Morning America. And the guy who did the weather at that time, who was a long time ago, a Ronald McDonald actor, he would people that had 100 birthdays, he would have their picture up and he'd say, oh, happy 100th birthday to so-and-so. There's so many of those, they had to drop that. They couldn't even continue to have it around. And now we see people that are 100 years old that are, you know, they're not just living to be 100. They're actually having lives. Right. They're doing things, getting things done at age 100. And so that's why definitely the product you're taking, the healthy lifestyle, that's all a trend. And the companies, the supplement companies, the people that build into that by saying, hey, it's going to be healthy, sell more stuff. It's a trend. And they say sell more stuff. So
right. So take the focus here and let's look at what are the different differentiation in between a trend and a fad, and how can somebody that is at the helm of a company or maybe a digital marketer, kind of mentioned to you in the pre-meeting here that I had the pleasure of speaking to a class of digital marketers. This is the future of the way things are going. And so there was two main questions. One of them is how do you really identify and monitor what trends are. And I think a secondary part of that is how do you identify if something is in fact a trend or if it's just a fad. So I wanted to get it like sort of from the source's mouth and get your thoughts on that,
Adam. Yeah, I've been asked that question for 20 years and people seem to think it's difficult and I don't find it that difficult. The way I would always start is anytime you start to see a pattern, that's a potential trend. Okay. Now, but when you see it, it's a potential trend and therefore we call it a fad. It's not a trend until you can demonstrate that it's a trend. So everything starts first as a behavior pattern we see, and we say, now, is that behavior pattern one-off? Is it short-lived or is it long-lived? If it's long-lived, it becomes a trend. Now, how do we go to identify that? And the number one thing you have to look at is there a demonstrable improvement in some measure of performance by the consumer? Okay. Are they somehow getting something out of this that lowers their cost? It reduces the amount of time it takes to get something done. It has other forms of lifestyle improvement. We always look for, does it improve their cost? Do they get more of something they want at less money? Sometimes it's so they get more of something they want at more money. They're paying more for it, but they're getting more of something they want. When we start to see that there is this demonstrated benefit, and it's a measurable benefit, then we can talk about it being a trend. So, we can go back and let's use some of them that are not so hot today, but that were very important. So back in the 1960s and 1970s, everybody focused in business on low cost. Manufacturing cost was considered like the key driver of success in business in those days. And so to get the lowest cost steel, we had these very large integrated steel plants like U.S. Steel, Bethlehem Steel. And these were very, very large plants covering many, many acres. They made very good product at a very low price. Now, was there a downside to these? Well, from a business perspective, most people would say no. But that was because they got used to the fact that they had to order the steel a long time in advance. You placed your order maybe a year in advance, and then you would modify the order as the dates got closer. So you would do a 6-month update, then you would do a 3-month update. But often around the 3-month update, you pretty much had to lock in on the product you were going to take in 3 months. And that was the way things worked in up into the 70s. And so then along came this idea of making steel with a small plant, and it was what we called a mini mill. And it was born in 1965. The technology was born. And what they did was they said, hey, we could take and put a steel mill, a much smaller steel mill, somewhere at a very, very much lower cost. Now, the downside was that the quality of the steel wasn't as good. In fact, there's certain kinds of steel initially they couldn't make at all. And the second, that was the biggest issue, was the quality. The price wasn't a big deal. But what they told people was they said, but we can make the steel on a 7-day schedule. You can give us an order a year out, but the reality is we can flex within 7 days. So the benefit there wasn't that it was lower cost. The benefit was it gave more flexibility to the buyer. And that was a very significant buyer benefit. So once the buyer recognized, oh, hey, look, I want to have a mini mill. And in the early days, it was a hybrid process. They would buy from Bethlehem Steel and say buy 80% of their known need. And then they'd say, because even a downturn, I'll need the 80%. But then they would flex by getting the balance of it from the mini mill that was closer by. So see, we have a demonstrated benefit. And then you can start to say, oh, the trend is going to be towards mini mills. Because the more they can get this flexibility, the more they would prefer it. And if we can track the mini mill's quality and cost, and if the quality of the mini mill product can get better, it will displace the larger plant because you will get the benefit of a shorter supply chain at the same price, right? So that's how we identify the trend, is we look for the benefit, and then we look at how can we measure it. And as we measure it, so in this case, the measurement initially was, what's my supply chain and how long would it take for how the ease of managing my supply chain? So, there's a lot of things that we can look at and become fads that stick around for a long time.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I tell people to be very careful. So one of the fads that stuck around for a long time was called the pet rock. And I really don't, I've kind of researched this. The idea, though, was really kind of a clever idea, which was that you would have a rock and you would call it Frank and you would have it on your desk and that would be your pet rock. And the idea was that, hey, if you talk to a dog who obviously can't talk back or you sit with a cat on your lap, they said, you know what, you know, this is not much of a two-way interaction. So consequently, it'll give you a rock and you can talk to the rock. And this became kind of a joke, but it was, became a fairly big business, and pet rocks were around for over a decade, and people literally went in stores and bought a little box with a rock in it, a little face on it, and they had a name for it. That was a fad, right? Because there was really no benefit to that. There was no measurable benefit to having a pet rock on your desk. And because of that, it was like, okay, these are going to go away. Now, they didn't go away in the first year. They didn't go away in the second year. And there were people who said, okay, we're going to have pet rocks around forever. And the issue is, no, we're not going to have pet rocks around forever. They'll go away. They're fad. You know, people are enjoying them. They're getting a kick out of it. But what's there? What's the real benefit that's going to keep you in the game?
Long-term benefit, right.
Yeah. This is why I keep saying over and over, I don't own any Bitcoin. And I would tell anybody, don't own any Bitcoin. Because right. I've been looking at Bitcoin now for nearly a decade. And I'm still waiting for somebody to explain to me the benefit they get out of owning Bitcoin. You know, I really, I'm not joking about that. I struggle. Now, there are benefits that I've identified, like if you want to do illegal transactions or you want to do off-book transactions that the IRS won't find, which again is could be an illegal, considered an illegal transaction. But those kinds of applications exist for Bitcoin. And yeah. I guess that's why, to some extent, there is a demand there and a measurable demand. There's a measurable demand for cocaine dealers and other drug dealers and people dealing in illegal behavior. There's a measurable amount of demand there that you could watch in Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies. Okay, cryptocurrencies. But when I look at it and say, well, where is that benefit? And how is Adam Harton going to benefit? Or how is Manny Tran going to benefit? Or how would JP Morgan benefit? Or Goldman Sachs? Or an investor like, you know, why should Tesla have these cryptocurrencies on their books instead of dollars or pounds or euros? And I've not yet gotten that answer. I had some heated debates with the people at Forbes over this about 8 years ago, and they just told me that I was an old man and I didn't get it. And I said, no, I think I get it. But I said, you know, people keep buying crypto, but I don't think it's going to be anything more than a fad. Eventually, it'll just be something that you'll have said, I bought crypto. And the one indication we've got of that was that during the pandemic, people got into buying the non-fungible tokens, you know, for art and things like that. And they paid thousands of dollars for some of these non-fungible tokens, and they can't sell them at all. There is no market for them. Not because
I think some of these things are.
Nobody's buying them.
Yes, I think some of these things are definitely premature. I think that there could be something in the future, but I agree with you on the crypto side. You know, people have made lots of money in it. There's a whole business model behind it. But I don't think it, for the reasons that we've talked about in previous podcasts, there's, you really can't, it's not protected by any of the, FDIC, any of the background stuff. It's a marketplace and framework that has no regulation, right? There's zero regulation. There's zero framework around it besides what people create. And I think that there's no backbone to it. So I totally get it. One of the things that I think confuses people out there when we use the word trend, they tend to relate it to trendy. This is trendy. So which I think is actually more like a trendy equals fad, in my opinion, yes. If you think about those words, because people think, oh, that's trendy. That's really trendy. Those boots are trendy, or this kind of car is trendy. These colors are trendy. They don't really recognize that that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about long-term business trends that are not going to be gone in a season.
So let's take, I'm going to go with that very directly. Whether or not the color of the shirt you wear, the number of buttons on the jacket you wear, the length of the hem on dresses that a woman might wear, or the length of the pants on anybody wear, the width of the leggings, you know, or the big or the narrow tight to your leg, all of those things are fads. You go watch a movie from the 1930s through the 1950s, and every man in the movie has a hat on who's outside, right? Today, if you see a man outside with a hat on at all, it's a baseball cap. So we went from everybody wore a hat to sort of people nobody wore a hat to now there are a lot of men wearing baseball caps, which I don't participate in, right? But those are by definition fads, even though they go for some of them a fairly long period of time because they can change so quickly. Now, that's a fad, but the trend towards luxury items is very, very real. Had you gone into the business of making high-end bags or high-end scarves or high-end jewelry and building a brand around it like Gucci did, I don't know if you've seen the movie about the Gucci family, but if you did that, you were on a trend, and that trend was towards people wanting to have a luxury good that they could carry, that made them feel good about themselves by having something high-end and demonstrated to other people their ability to have a high-end product. And that was the trend towards luxury goods. And that trend really took off in the 80s. It started then. And if you'd have been, in the fashion business, what you'd have said is, I have a choice between, selling product in JCPenney or trying to be this luxury brand, Tiffany's being an example of a luxury brand at the time, then you would have been much smarter to have gone towards the luxury end, even though it was a smaller base. You're selling fewer product, but at a much, much higher price point. And a lot of people said, oh, it's just for the very rich. But it turned out that no, the middle class wanted to have one of these things that a very rich person might have a closet full of, right? A middle-class person might want one Rolex, whereas a very wealthy person might have, 200 very high-end watches, Piagets and other kinds of watches that are much more expensive than Rolexes, for example. So the difference there, obviously, is the difference between, the implementation, which is faddish, which is, the clothing themselves, and the trend is luxury goods. And we can measure the sales of luxury goods, right? And then we can start to measure the age of the buyer, and we could measure the income of the buyer. So if you said, okay, the person who shopped at Tiffany's was, a woman in her 50s with a net worth of $1.4 million in 1970, you could start to track that. Say, wow, look, the average age is going down, and the average net worth of the buyer is going down. We have people now that are coming in spending $10,000 on a diamond with a net worth of $50,000, right? Or diamond earrings, And so that's when you start to really demonstrate that there is a trend, so that we can identify that benefit that people have, and then we can start to put some measurement against it. Now, let's take, for example, another one. What's going to happen in recreation? You and I did a podcast a few years ago talking about Winnebago, the company, and talking about during the early days of the pandemic, sales of recreational vehicles skyrocketed. And the question was, is that a trend or a fad? Will that continue? It historically has been very cyclical, that people bought them when times were good and they didn't buy them when times weren't so good. And the question became, what was the pattern that was developing? And so now you had to break it into demographics. What do people that are, over 50, maybe over 60, people over 50, 40, 30, work it all the way down to younger people, and what is the pattern in terms of their purchase rates? So I don't know the RVs that well. I do know, for example, in motorcycles. Buyers of motorcycles, if you went back to the 1970s, the average buyer of a motorcycle was in their 20s, almost universally. It's a few in their early 30s. As time went on, the average age of motorcycles went up. There was an explosion of sales in motorcycles from the 1960s up to about 1988. The market just expanded. And it was, not only were sales of Harley Davidson very good, but you saw the reemergence of the Indian brand as a new product line back on the market. Honda was a massive force. There were more Honda motorcycles sold than all the brands combined. Then you had Suzuki, you had Yamaha, you had the European bikes as well. But the market expanded dramatically. But then what we saw was after 1990, about 88 to 90, that market started to shrink. And we could start to see the demographic shift. Younger people weren't buying motorcycles. Just quite simply, the demographic shifted. So now it was hidden because you had people like myself of my age who in the 1990s, they were now getting into their late 30s or in their 40s, that sort of boomer generation. And they would go out and buy their first motorcycle at age 45. And then it got to the point they'd buy their first motorcycle at age 55. So if you were looking at sales of motorcycles, you would say, oh, look, this isn't a problem. But if you were looking at who was buying them and the demographics and you were tracking that, then you start to say, uh-oh, this is a trend that went up from sort of World War II. It kept growing all the way up into the 80s, but then it started to revert. And now that trend is not continuing, and the motorcycle business is going to be problematic. It'll be oversupplied. There'll be too many dealers. There'll be too much product. And companies that were totally reliant on the sale of motorcycles, like Harley Davidson, we're going to start finding it harder and harder to maintain their business, right? So that's where we, once you see something and you think, okay, start with it's a fad. Just let's say, what's the benefit that people get out of it? Why did people buy motorcycles in the early days? They were a very inexpensive form of transportation. That was what launched it off. They were cheap to buy compared to a car, and they used very little fuel compared to a car. And anybody could keep one running. Mechanic sense could be very, very small. As time went on, it became a little bit more of a lifestyle issue, as people thought that, okay, I can be an accountant and I can ride a motorcycle on the weekends, and it kind of separates me out and lets me have some individuality. And we could track the number of people doing that and look at their occupations. And then, and if you were doing that, like I said, if you were doing that, then you would have been very smart in your company. And like Honda, they branched out into so many other products, right? They had the automobile business, which they kept forefront. Then they also had their yard business, right? They had lawnmowers,
generators.
Right? Yeah, right. And then they got into what they also got into making small airplanes, right? And so Honda's in a whole, they're in medical products now, and the kind of where GE was 15, 20 years ago in terms of a company. They've branched out into a lot of other products and diversified so that they aren't just known as a motorcycle company. So is that sort of, do you think we're kind of getting at what the people?
Yeah, I think we're getting at that. I think, as the class I spoke to, they're all in a digital marketing class. And so their job is going to be being able to take a product or service and being able to stand it up on social media, stand it up on the web, so that consumers like you and I and others can not only be exposed to it, but can find the value in it. And I did talk a lot about how important it is to understand your customer. And I think understanding the difference between that, the trend and a fad, and how it pertains to the long term value is one thing. But from a very brass tacks version, I mentioned that the census reports are good places to get information on trends. The news sources can be plus or minus on that. Obviously there's going to be lots of bias. I also did mention bias and how important it is to be aware of it and how to try to mitigate those factors that drive the bias in people. What other tangible things can you point to, Adam, where as sources for trends besides the news media, besides the census reports? Can you think of any place else where you can find information on trends?
Well, like I said, it's typically you don't monitor the trend. You monitor the underlying behavior. What are people getting out of it? And can I measure the value that they get out of it? And can I measure how well it works? So let's take, for example, cell phones. Cell phones came on the market. Cell phones grew fairly rapidly. As the cost went down, the number of people owned one went up. There was a breakthrough that happened, though, whenever the BlackBerry came out. And when the BlackBerry came out, you saw this suddenly saw this different kind of behavior, right? And people really got connected up to their phones. I called them crackberries. And so what you have to do is look and say, why? What's going on there? What's that behavior? Is this a fad or a trend? And what we could see was that the crackberry gave you this asynchronous communication capability. In other words, instead of just talking on the phone, which required you and I be on the phone at the same time, you could do this texting thing. And the texting thing allowed me to be asynchronous. I could send you a message, and then you could wait and send me one back, right? And then as time went on, we added email capability. And now you've got three levels of connectivity. You've got immediate, I'm talking on the phone. We've got asynchronous texting, something that I think it's important enough to, I want to get your presence. Then the third one is email, which is, I need you to respond on this, but it's not as critical, it's not as urgent as texting would be. And then you start seeing, wow, this means that mobile phones are going to explode like crazy. Not because people are talking more, it was the opposite. They're talking less. And the people that's figured out how, what they wanted, people are now wanting a handheld device that lets them get their job done, lets them communicate, and lets them operate asynchronously. So you start seeing early on things like stock tracking applications, right? I wonder what's happening with my stocks. Because that historically was something very difficult to find out. The only way you could do it was to sit in front of that old horizontal screen and watch the ticker go by, the old ticker tape. Or you could call someone on the phone, a broker, and say, what's the current price of a stock? What's the high or low today? But when you could say, I can get that right on my phone and I can do it whenever I want, all of a sudden that made it a very, very valuable tool, right?
Right.
And so we start to see the behavior change. We start seeing people pick up and use more of a product. Then start to get to the underlying sense of why they're doing it. Then we look at the demographics of the buyer. geographically where they're located, how old are they, ethnicity, background, that kind of thing, what's happening across the age groups. And then we can start to track the improvement. So you would look at that, and back again, if you went back to about 2005 or 2010 in that range, then there was no way you would lose money in the app business, because all of a sudden you had people looking for these asynchronous opportunities to do things. I mean, I never forget meeting a guy that took the game. I don't play games. It was like, it has a name that starts with a T, but it had these little characters that were like, looked like kind of like little sevens, and you could flip them around in circles. Tetris, that's right. And this game had existed on a computer. And so it was a Russian game, and he had gotten somehow the code, and he was the first one to put Tetris on a phone. And he told me that he did that. He was telling the story, not just to me. It was giving a presentation, right? And so in the presentation, he said he saw that, and he figured out how to put it onto a phone. I think initially he put it on the BlackBerry, and it might have been the iPhone, I don't remember. But the net of it was that in the very first month, he sold $100,000 worth of the product. Right. Well, why? Because now people had a game they could play on their phone. So if you're commuting, remember the old days when we had to get on trains and commute to work and pre-pandemic, people wanted something to entertain themselves. Well, now you can play Tetris on your phone. Right. And so back again to having something at your fingertips, lets you operate in an asynchronous way. That sort of thing was a big win. So you look for the behavior, and then you start saying, what's the underlying factor of the behavior? And then we can start tracking that. So you started tracking the explosion in the development of apps, right? And how many more of them came out? The old iPhone ad from 20 years ago, whatever you want to do, there's an app for that, made the product a very valuable product. And what we tend to see is people don't look at the world through this idea of what are the behaviors that people have and how do we track their behavior. Instead, they tend to look at how much do they buy with what I sell, and are the sales of what I have going up or going down. So again, that's why Harley-Davidson was missing the fact that their marketplace was dying, literally, because it was aging so fast out from under them and lacking another product line. What are they going to do? And I think right now this kind of leads to an interesting story that's happening in the current press, which is we have this transition happening from internal combustion automobiles to electric automobiles. And all these implications that are happening about it, so it's an interesting thing people talk about. The first thing is to recognize that, yes, it's going to happen. And I was a very early convert back in 2009. I said that electric vehicles are going to be dominant. And why would I do that? Well, because when I would talk to people that owned a Prius, what I heard over and over was that they made an investment in the car, in capital, and then they had to put less money into the variable cost, which was the fuel. So if I'm buying gasoline, I don't know what the price per gallon will be, but that's a variable. And if I replace that with a capital investment, then I don't have to deal with the variable cost anymore. And you saw it especially in college people, anyone where the vehicle is supplied by a third party. So I would talk to college kids and high school kids, and I'd say, why would you want a Prius? When I was in high school, I wanted a big, giant car with all kinds of power. I wanted to show off to the girls. And they'd say, well, wait a minute. If my dad buys me a car and he gets me a Prius, it's electric, and it didn't cost me anything to operate it.
Yeah, right.
And I'm like, okay. I started to see that this was really, and if you look, that's always been a long-term trend. We forever, as people and as business people, anytime we could use capital, we would do that to displace variable costs. Could I buy a piece of equipment to do what a human does? The capital, and so I make the investment, then I go again and again, and I can improve it often, make it better, improve the speed, improve the capability. In the case of these vehicles, battery costs are going down, the cost of maintenance goes away. There's these, you start looking at those factors and saying, wow, now I understand why electrified vehicles are going to just be the big wave that they're going to be.
Yeah.
We forward up to today, you got Tesla, which is doing pretty well. But it's interesting to look at what happened with GM and Ford. GM was trying to go out and launch electric vehicles, and I don't think they've been very successful at all. Ford really committed to this. Ford came in and said, you know what? Our car business isn't very good. We sold a lot of Tauruses, but our car business is just not that good. And so they said, we're going to really focus on SUVs and pickups.
Yeah.
A lot of people are like, you got to be crazy. You can't be in business if you don't sell cars.
Yeah, I remember
like,
when they did that, it was a huge, sent shockwaves through the industry when they decided to basically walk away from the car business.
But what they recognized was, hey, the market is changing. It's changing dramatically. How are we going to participate? So they said, let's try to focus in on one segment where we're doing very well. And that was the pickups. And then what did they do? They made an electric pickup, right? The first one out there with an electric pickup. Tesla doesn't have one yet. The Rivian's not successful. There's really nobody, but you got the Ford F-150 Lightning is available to be purchased, although it's in small quantities. So they get to market with that first. Number two, what Ford did was they said, we're going to create two companies. We're going to have Ford, and I think that one's called Ford Blue. One is a traditional internal combustion engine vehicle company. The other one's going to be a standalone electric vehicle company. And what they're saying is the market will determine the success of these two businesses. We're not going to be in a game of trying to, you know, keep both of them alive unless they both can be successful. And if they compete, yeah, they compete. You know, that's just the way it's going to be. That is the way we know successful companies operate. But if you look at the stock market today, Ford is getting clobbered. It's getting hammered. It's getting killed. Now, nobody's real happy with GM either, to be honest with you. But people hate Ford. Now, what I would say is they have the best shot of anybody out there of being able to maintain this position in electric yeah. trucks. And if you think about how many trucks are, think about step vans. Think about the delivery
fleet
vehicles.
Stuff. All the fleet stuff, right?
Yeah. There's a very good chance that they're going to end up in a very good position in that marketplace, yeah. that, and it will transition quickly. And, you know, so I'm a fan. Now, again, we don't recommend stocks. We don't tell people to buy stocks. But I would say that from a management point of view, they have recognized the trend, and they are organizing the company to deal with the trend, and they are handling yeah. it in the best way. So the fact
and
that
they have I think they have the advantage in that they are a long-term car company that's got the dealer network, it's got the brand recognition. Of course, everybody is in love with Tesla at the moment, but like you said, from a deployment standpoint, they have the fleets. You know, if you have either plumber cars or construction cars that are delivery vehicles that are going out for the day, I think it just makes a lot of sense to be able to electrify those vehicles. And I think Ford has the best shot of doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so again, from a management perspective, it's a trend. They caught the trend, and then they reorganized to deal with the trend, which is what I think we want our listeners to understand. So trends are not that obtuse. Just start off with anything you look at, collection of people's behaviors, look at that, and start off saying it's a fad. It's not a trend. It's a fad.
Yeah.
And try to see, is there an underlying benefit to people from doing this? Because if there is, the fad will become a trend because they're getting a benefit out of it. And typically, it's not going to be a benefit that's measured in the most critical item, like the cost of the component, for example. It'll be something like it saves me time, you know, it helps me get the job done, makes me feel good about my, you know, something, you know, whatever, right? I mean, I did one of these, believe it or not, for a religious organization. And the reality is that in the United States and in most of the world, attendance at Christian churches is going down, including the Catholic Church and that, you know, I'm trying to, whether it's Catholic or Protestant, attendance is down. Now, the evangelical side is way up. Well, what are we looking at? Well, the trend has become one in which the more people are saying, I don't get a lot of value out of going to a church, whether it's Catholic or Protestant. So the trend is away from that. The trend is away from being church going, very much so compared to the 1940s, 50s, 60s. There's far, far fewer people going. But the people who go are much more involved. Right? Yeah. If they go, they tend to be much more evangelical if they're Protestant or very strict Catholics, you know, that adhere to some of the principles that were been existent of having children, you know, that kind of thing. And so it's become the trend is away from religion, Christian religion, but the trend it could be hidden by the evangelical movement, which is a very small part of the population, but very, very vocal. Right. And so now, yeah. If you're out there trying to make decisions about which one of these you want to appeal to and how you want to appeal to them in advertising and have the conversation, it helps you to clarify the discussion that you want to have.
Yeah. I think these are all great things. And, you know, I want to remind our listeners and our viewers that we have a report called Trend Report 2030 that really details the top 66 trends that we've identified in the world. And, you know, one of the things that I want to say here before we close out, it's a really cool story. You might have heard it, Adam. When you mentioned earlier the luxury brands, so the daughter of Bernard Arnault, who is the chairman and major stockholder of LVMH, of course, Louis Vuitton, so forth, his daughter got married, and it's supposed to be the wedding of the century, right? It came in at a price tag of $7 million. Now, here's one of the things that he did that I thought was brilliant. So he helped to organize his daughter's wedding. Of course, he'd go and talk to these venue people or the cake maker or the people that make the wedding dress. And of course, these people are excited, right? So they went up to him and they said, "Hey, listen, you know, we're going to sell you this dress. We're going to sell you this cake, whatever it might be. And here's the price that we're going to offer you." Of course, they inflated the price. And he instead went to them and said, "Okay, thanks for your offer. But think of it this way. What sort of value will you take in the fact that you will be giving your cake or your wedding dress or whatever it is to the top ever wedding of the century?" So he actually flipped it over and got a lot of these things for free because he told the people, the vendors, that they would be able to advertise the fact that they were the cake maker, they were the wedding dress maker of the famous LVMH chairman's daughter's wedding. So I heard that. I just thought it was brilliant how he was able to kind of turn it around. Okay, so any final thoughts here before we close off for the week?
I just remind people that if you're not planning for the future, then you're going to fail if you plan from the past. Like, go get our book. Our classware is not that expensive, and it'll change the way you think about strategic planning and dramatically improve your odds of success.
Very well said, Adam. All right. Well, with that, we will log off for this week. We'll talk to you guys next week. Of course, reach out to Adam or I at manny@sparkpointers.com or adam@sparkpointers.com. If you have any questions or you want to bring us in to do an assessment of your organization, we can help in many different ways. And we're here available. This is what we do. And with that, we'll sign off for this week. Thanks again, Adam.
Thank you.
Cheers. Perfect.